Hi!
Hello!
This is Janooni.
And this is Sonia.
Welcome back to another episode of Beaker Bros.
Today we have a very exciting guest. Her name is Dr. Ada Tang. And fun little fact, she is my undergraduate thesis supervisor along with Kenneth Noguchi. But today we'll be interviewing her and we'll just let that interview speak for itself. So ladies and gentlemen,
enjoy the episode.
Yeah, and I'll just be reading off a little bit of an introduction here. So Dr. Ada Tang is an associate professor and assistant dean for the School of Rehab Sciences at McMaster University. To top it off, she's also a licensed physical therapist. And as the principal investigator of the Max Stroke Canada Lab, Dr. Tang and her team focuses on examining the impact of exercise on cardiovascular health in people with stroke and other populations. Everyone, please welcome Dr. Tang.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So I'm just going to start off by doing like a quick, just a couple of questions we had. Just some of our general interests and some also other people that were interested in your career and just kind of have you kind of gone from a physiotherapist to becoming a researcher. So the first question we have is, what did you want to be when you were a kid? What drew you to the rehab sciences and PT versus other disciplines?
I don't think I landed on being a PT till I was coming to the end of high school. I played around with lots of different career options. I loved music and I thought I wanted to be a music teacher. Like I was in the high school band and I really liked that. I liked health. My parents, as you know, an immigrant family had said, you know, you should be a doctor. And I had no real interest in being a doctor. But I took one of my phys ed courses that I took actually had a lot of anatomy in it. And that's what actually really got me interested in the human body. We learned about muscles and their actions and insertions and, you know, and that I was like, oh, maybe there's something else to this, right? Like maybe there's something. And that's how I got into physiotherapy. I didn't really know much about it. I hadn't, you know, been to see a physiotherapist, but I liked the fact that it worked with muscles and bones and it was like really interesting. So yeah, I had applied and got into the program at the University of Toronto. So that's where I did my PT training.
That's so fascinating because even me, like as a high school student, I was into like the whole music and the French and also the sciences. And again, as like coming from an immigrant family too, there's that whole like expectation to be a doctor. Like me, on the other hand, I still like have an interest in medicine, but I never really got that opportunity to be in the phys ed class and like be able to explore like anatomy and stuff. So it's really fascinating that you were given that opportunity, like kind of led you to your passion.
Just a quick question on that. So is the physical therapy program that you did an undergrad program then? So you did that like right out of, oh, I didn't know they had that.
Yeah, back in the day. So this is how old I am. But back in the day, PT was a bachelor program.
That's wild.
And now it's a grad program, which is so cool.
Yeah, very cool. So I guess as a follow-up to that then, so after you did your undergrad in PT, you went on to do a master's in rehab sciences and then a PhD in medical sciences, if I'm correct. So what drew you to that path then? So I guess going from rehab science specifically then to med sci.
Yeah, well, even before I went to do my master's, I worked as a PT for many, many years. I didn't even, you know, research and grad school wasn't even on my radar. I really loved working with people. I really loved my job as a PT. So the difference between rehab science and medical science in our program at U of T was only because there wasn't a PhD program in rehab science at that time. So the supervisor that I was working with, Dr. Dina Brooks, she had an appointment in the Institute of Medical Science. And so she was still able to supervise me, but I was just in medical science. But we still did rehab research projects.
Gotcha.
Go ahead.
We both have so many questions. So then what do you miss then, since you're full-on researcher right now, that's like your main thing from my understanding, what do you miss about being a practicing physiotherapist?
Lots. I mean, I really valued the time that I was a physio. I valued so many things about it. I loved working with the patients and their families. I loved feeling part of, you know, their recovery. I worked with people with stroke, but also people after brain injuries. I worked with older adults, like geriatric rehab, but most of my time was in brain injury and stroke. And when you experience, like when my patients experience something, such a major, major life event, like a brain injury or a stroke, it could have been a traumatic brain injury or anything like that. So I worked with people of all ages. There's, you know, it completely uproots your whole life, right? And your family's life. And like, you know, there's a lot of uncertainties and a lot of unknowns. And so, you know, to be part of the rehab team and be such a important part of that kind of, you know, initial stage of their recovery was really satisfying for me, because, you know, they're trying to figure out what their new life is going to look like, how their body works now after this, you know, major event. And I was only one part of the team, right? There was a much larger team who was involved. So I really loved working with the interdisciplinary team. I loved seeing the progress of the patients as they moved through their recovery and was like, you know, getting ready to go home and looking forward to like what was going to be the next steps and helping them get ready for that. That was something that was always, always, always so fulfilling. When I got into research, I had a real genuine interest in, you know, inquiry and discovery and all of those things. But I also still really loved, I really wanted to make sure my research was clinically focused because I had so much clinical like interest, right? So the work that we do in exercise and stroke is all very founded on, I feel like, you know, it was important for me in my career to keep it very founded on clinically important research questions, things that will be very important to the participants that come into our study, things that will be important for future people with stroke, and things that will be important for clinicians or health professionals or anyone that will be working with people with stroke in the future.
So fascinating. So,
yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. So all I was going to say was like, this is how I, you know, really tried to blend, you know, my interests and my background as a physiotherapist with now my interests as a researcher and really trying to still, you know, stay true to, you know, both of my passions.
I was going to ask, was there like ever a turning point where you were like, as a practicing physiotherapist, you were like, oh, I want to go into research. Like, was there just like a moment that like, this is what you wanted to do? Or was it just something that like kind of gradually happened that you're like, you went into research?
Yeah, I'll say it actually happened in two different ways. So as a practicing physiotherapist and thinking about research, that was something that kind of grew, like it started off as a little spark and it grew over time. While I was working, so this was in Toronto, I was working in a large rehab facility in Toronto. It was fully affiliated with the University of Toronto. So I was still really close to the PT program at U of T. I took PT students on their placements. I also then started to do some tutoring, some lab instruction for the PT program at U of T. And then so over that time, I started like really, really loving teaching too. And it was also at that time that, so, you know, I had said that my bachelor's, my PT training was in my bachelor's, sorry, undergrad. They were transitioning to now the master's level PT training. And so, you know, for myself as having, you know, only a BSc in PT, if I wanted to continue teaching at U of T, my thought was I should think about upgrading my own degree, right? And going back to school and getting a master's myself if I wanted to continue teaching at U of T. So that's how that started. But my intention at that time was really like, okay, I'll do a 2-year master's and then, you know, go back to being a PT because I loved it so much. But it was during my master's then my supervisor said, yeah, like, so you're going to do a PhD, right? And I'm like, what? No, I mean, that was not on my radar. And she planted that seed in my head. And I started to think about, well, okay, if I go on to do my PhD, what happens to the PT side of me? Right. And so then that was like, I think the bigger crossroads for me, you know, do I go back to like being a PT, which I loved, and I had always intended to go kind of back to that role, or do I go on this new path that becomes more and more kind of research intensive, you know, as I go along, does that mean I'm kind of, you know, stepping away from being a PT? So coming back to kind of what I was talking about before, I obviously chose to do the PhD route, but in doing so, I felt it was really important for me to continue, you know, being still grounded in those clinically relevant research questions. And then that's how I reconciled it in my mind.
Very cool. Can I ask one more question before?
Yeah, go for it.
The next thing? So like with all the, first of all, that resonates so much with me right now, just because, as you know, I'm like considering applying to med school and then going into my master's right now. And like just hearing how you've been able to balance both of the professions while still being able to make a meaningful impact, that resonates a lot. That's very cool to hear. But I guess my next question is on topic of getting PhDs. This is sort of like a baseline question, but first, what is the value of getting a PhD? And second, can you think of an example where having a PhD may be a detriment to someone's resume or CV or anything?
I would say, I mean, it would be a detriment if you didn't really have a goal for it or a purpose for it. You know, PhD, you can imagine, is, you know, it's not a small feat, right? And to embark on something like a PhD, like it's 4 years of like really, really intense work. So if anyone was thinking about doing a PhD, you know, I often talk to potential PhD students in my lab, right? Like, what is it that you hope to get out of a PhD? Because I don't want you to make this decision lightly. Like, it's an investment, it's 4 years of your life, right? And 4 years of my life that I'll be working with you. And so I really want to make sure that it's the right decision. So I would hope that a PhD wouldn't be detrimental to anyone's CV, as long as at the front end, they're very clear on the reasons for doing a PhD. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Like, obviously, like the skills and stuff that you gain from a PhD, that in itself is super valuable. But if, I guess what you're saying, if the time isn't worth it intrinsically, or if it isn't meaningful for you, that's where it could be, you know, not something that you necessarily want to do.
Yeah. And at the end of 4 years, right, if you look back at those 4 years of your PhD and you're like, well, what did I gain out of it? Then that's not, that's, I hope that nobody gets to that point.
Gotcha.
I just want to start with the next question we have, where basically, so in academia, there has been a push to view students and emerging researchers as valued individuals rather than numbers. In your opinion, to what degree do established researchers and institutions who are looking to take on graduate students or postdocs value extracurriculars or life experience over having a history of grant funding, publishing, awards, and all that fun stuff?
I think it depends on the faculty member and the supervisor, you know, how much value people may put on those different things. I value it very, very highly. And it's something that, you know, we really pride ourselves in our lab. Sonia may have something to say about this, but, you know, pride ourselves in our lab in having people from very diverse backgrounds and very diverse interests. And, you know, when we have lab meeting, yeah, we talk about the research, but we also talk about, you know, how bigger issues when we can. And, you know, it's not just about the research that we're doing, but it's also about, you know, how we're doing it and why it matters, and how do we make sure that we keep doing it well, not just from a research point of view, but even from a social point of view, right? And these are some of the conversations that we've been having as a lab in terms of, you know, making sure we're very inclusive, or trying to make sure that we're inclusive in our research practices, and we're equitable when, you know, and how do we do that, and what does that look like? In terms of, like, I mean, you know, scholarships and other things like that, it can also make a difference in, you know, people's applications to those when you show that you have different interests and different experiences. Some of the really prestigious awards that we have in Canada value leadership as equally with academia, like academic excellence and research. Like, all of those things are rated very equally. So, you know, that kind of thing can be really important. When it comes to academic scholarships, obviously, like, the numbers game is still going to be the key, right? What is your GPA, and how many presentations have you given, and how many publications have you published, and that kind of thing. But if there's if there's that as well as excellence in other areas, extracurricular areas, leadership and community service or anything like that, then that I think separates, you know, a good student and excellent students from really, really excellent students. So I think, you know, that's why I place really high value on that.
Gotcha. And if I can just add to that, so for the audience, I guess, right now I'm doing my undergraduate thesis project with the Maxro Canada Lab, which Dr. Tang runs. And I also did my research practicum with the lab. And if I must say, on topic of the previous question, I remember when applying, there was no mention of like, what's your GPA? You know, what's your overall whatever? And I'm not sure if that was a conscious decision from, maybe it was, if you're nodding your head yes. But I think, at least for me, as a starting researcher, just getting a taste of, you know, everything that research has to offer, that was the single greatest like enabler for me to be able to pursue research. Because at the time, my GPA was horrible, we'll say, but it's improved, so we're okay now. But yeah, so like on topic of not viewing people as just a number, like this lab gave me that opportunity that I probably wouldn't have had if, you know, I had to submit my GPA.
Thank you so much for saying that, Sonia. That means a lot to me.
Thank you for letting me say that. But I guess on topic of our next question then, so going back to the Maxro Canada Lab, what's the Maxro Canada Lab origin story? How'd the lab get started, and then how did you get started with it?
It started with me, I guess. I got my faculty position at Mac. So I've been at Mac since 2013. It's coming up to 10 years now, which is unbelievable. And as a, you know, a young, fresh faculty member, I had to start a lab. So I didn't have any grad students at that time, you know, and I started small. I started with a 303 student and a research volunteer. And, you know, I was like, well, I'm going to make a lab. I could call it the Stroke Rehabilitation Research Lab, but that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, McMaster brands everything as Mac something or something Mac. And so I'm like, Mac Stroke. Okay. So you're going to laugh at this story. I'm like, Mac Stroke. That sounds good. So I Googled Mac Stroke to see if somebody else had Mac Stroke. And sure enough, there's some company who I think is like an IT support or help desk on Macs in Thailand. And so I couldn't use Mac Stroke by itself. So I stuck a Canada in the end. And that's how we became Mac Stroke Canada.
That's so funny. I remember when I was making the poster for my like lab, or not lab, like my study, and I only wrote Mac Stroke. I didn't add Canada in it. And I think you made that comment. And I was like, how did you know that? When do you look that up? But anyways, that's funny. So that's pretty much, you started small and then you just grew from there.
Started small and grew from there. Yeah, just like anything else that, you know, you do. It's like building a, you know, building a little lab. Started off, we didn't even have space at that time. And then slowly grown to what it is today. And I love where it is today. I love the group. I love, you know, how dynamic it is, how everyone is so supportive of each other, how close-knit everyone is with each other, but also, you know, pushes each other to work hard. And it's come to such a great place. I'm so grateful for everyone that's in the lab and everything that everyone does to contribute to it.
That's amazing. I know you said how they're like, you're reaching your 10 years soon. My next question is, where do you see Mac Stroke Canada and your role with the lab heading in the next decade, the next 10 years?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll continue to grow. And, you know, take students and grad students. I love how we have, you know, students from kind of all levels of training. I don't know, we'll see where the future lands. Like we're still, you know, working on a range of different projects. We've moved into different areas. Some of the newer directions we've been moving into is around, you know, technology and tele-rehab to provide access to different rehab services, and how can we facilitate that? I mean, the COVID pandemic has definitely accelerated that whole line of research in ways that we couldn't have even imagined. You know, things like Zoom that we're talking on right now is so ubiquitous that wouldn't have been as well accepted, right, or easily accepted, especially to older adults and people with stroke as it would have been before this pandemic. Some other new areas that we're looking at is kind of intersections with sex and gender and how those interplay with stroke and exercise and participation in physical activity. So a couple of our students are interested in looking at that, and that's such a new area and really a poorly understood area about how sex, are there sex differences in how males and females respond to exercise, or even how men and women even choose to participate in exercise or stay active, right? And often with women, there's a lot of kind of competing demands with, you know, their life and, you know, their family commitments and whatnot, that then, you know, why is it that women are less likely to participate in our studies, and how can we support them to continue to be active even after a stroke? So things like that, I think, are important to be able to understand and then be able to help future people with stroke.
Wow, I was gonna say that's so fascinating, like how you kind of just like there's a knowledge and like a gap in the knowledge here. And I didn't even realize the whole like women not participating more in these studies. I didn't even know that was a thing until like you brought it up. And it's something really interesting that like to see you guys explore. Like I'm definitely gonna follow up and see where that goes.
All right, awesome. And then I guess slightly shifting gears a little bit, our next question is more about knowledge translation. So beyond the technical work involved with being a scientist, obviously engaging in SciComm and knowledge translation is also an integral part of that. So how do you personally engage in knowledge translation within academia, but also to non-academic audiences?
So within academia, you know, the traditional means of peer review publications and scientific conferences, right? Those are really standard. But because of, I think, the clinical relevance of like what I hope to always be able to do, I always try to make sure that there's a clinical message to our studies too, right? So we've done the study, why does it matter to the research community, but also why does it matter to the clinical community? And so through that, I still have lots of really great contacts with people who are still based in the hospital, still working at the front lines. And so being able to share the results of our research through, you know, lunchtime, lunch and learns, or, you know, in services or research rounds or things like that is really important to me. Formally, but also informally. So as I'm chatting with physiotherapists or other rehab professionals in stroke rehab, whether it's in Hamilton or anywhere else, you know, I'll talk about the research that we're doing so that, you know, they can be aware of some of the things that might be coming down the research pipeline. A couple of things that we've also been doing as a lab is to create like little infographics or visual abstracts or video abstracts that will accompany our papers as they're being published. So we tweet those out, we post them on our Instagram as one small way. We probably could be doing more to, you know, extend the reach of our messaging. So, you know, being able to come on a podcast like this is really great because I think this also helps to reach people using a different medium. So, you know, thinking about science communication and what you're doing with Beaker Bros is really terrific, I think.
Thank you. And then I guess before you get to the last question, I have a quick follow-up to that. So me personally, I'm doing the OEP conference in July. We're still set to do that. And I guess on topic of what you were saying about conferences, I was wondering if you ever had like a rough experience at a conference presentation, how you navigated that, and just general tips you have while presenting.
Sonia, you'll be great at OEP.
Thanks.
OEP is the Ontario Exercise Physiology Conference. So that'll be your first conference?
Yep.
Yay.
Have I had a rough go? I don't know. I mean, maybe. Maybe I blocked it out of my mind. I'm definitely still nervous when I present at conferences, even now, right? Because, you know, sometimes it depends on who I'm speaking to. And when it's an unknown entity, you know, an unknown audience, I don't, you know, I definitely still get nervous, but I think a lot of preparation is key. So I do a lot of practice before a presentation. If I'm presenting a poster, I'll pour over the poster and make sure, you know, or my slides, I'll make sure like every detail is like just right. And I practice my script over and over again. Like I rehearse it a lot, maybe more than most people might need to, but I feel more confident going into a presentation if I do that.
Okay. That's fascinating. I was gonna say like, go ahead. These are great tips for Sonia.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, well, I'm glad you never had like an utter disaster, or even if you did, at least you don't remember it. So that's good.
I'm pretty sure like all my bad presentation experiences have been from like elementary school, where I've been like completely so nervous speaking. I'm just like sweaty palms and everything. It's really just a book talk at this point. There's nothing crazy going on, but it's just so fascinating to see like how many, so many years have prepared you. You still get like those like nerves and the jitters, but you've been able to manage them, find ways that like kind of help you out and still be amazing at doing presentations and conferences.
I think it, you know, it comes down to controlling what you can control, right? So I know that I can control my part of the presentation. I don't know what the questions are going to be coming at me. So that's the part that does make me nervous. Like, I don't know, someone might come out from left field and like try to slam me with some really difficult question, but I can't control that. So I can control the part that I can control, and I can control the messaging that I want to give out to my audience. So in that way, hopefully, you know, I'm directing them to invite the questions that, you know, I feel that I can answer. If somebody is going to come and hit me out from left field, I have no control over that.
Yeah, that's a good outlook, I guess. Control what you can, and whatever you can't, just hope it goes okay. Gotcha.
For our last question, this is kind of a fun question. So beyond academia, like who is Dr. Tang? Like how do you separate life from like academics?
That's such a great question. I don't know. Okay, so who am I generally? I am from Toronto originally. I'm not sure if this is what you want to hear.
Whatever comes to mind.
Born and raised there. So I'm a Toronto girl, Scarborough actually. And then I had done, I'd done all of my university degrees at U of T. I did my bachelor PT there. And then my master's and my PhD all at U of T. So if you look at my CV, it says U of T, U of T, U of T. I had a chance to move out to BC for a few years where I did my postdoc. And that was such an amazing opportunity for us to do that. So my husband and I moved out. It was a great kind of learning opportunity to be in the lab that I went to. But it also really solidified kind of our love for the outdoors and for nature and for just the healing of trees and oceans. And I know we don't have that here in Ontario, but I feel like there's something about, you know, being out in nature that I always liked here when I grew up in Toronto, but I didn't have the same exposure. Like it was just really easy when we lived out west to be, you know, 20 minutes, you're in a mountain. Like it was so simple. We also did a lot of paddling out there. We did kind of this outrigger paddling and dragon boat paddling when we were out there. So we were out on the water probably about 5 days a week. We lived really close to False Creek. So, you know, I could go and pop an outrigger canoe and have a paddle for an hour in the morning before I even started my day. And it was beautiful. The water was usually glass at that time of day. You know, seals are popping their heads up in the water. And it was just such a wonderful, I'm not even a morning person, you don't even understand, but I will get up and go on the water in the mornings because it was just such a magical time of day. And it was just a wonderful way to, you know, start the day. Anyway, so having said that, now that we're back in Ontario, I'm happy to be back here. Our family and friends are, you know, just down the road in Toronto, but, you know, really try to make the use of, you know, all of the amazing trails that we have here in Ontario. We live close to the lake here, which I'm very grateful for. Our Great Lakes are just incredible bodies of water that remind me so much of being by the ocean, like the vastness of even Lake Ontario, which isn't even the biggest lake, you know, can be as angry with these massive, powerful waves and it feels like I'm standing on the edge of the ocean. And sometimes it's beautiful and calm, and sometimes it gets this like beautiful crystal blue color, like I could be down in the Caribbean. Like Lake Ontario has so many moods, and I get a lot of healing from water and trees. And so that's kind of a little bit about who I am and who we are. And the other things that kind of interest me outside of school and work.
Well, just to add on to the BC thing, I'm a huge hiker as well. I literally bought a ticket to BC at the end of the school year. So literally, I'm just going to book off. I'm going to go see one of my friends and just go hiking for like a week. So very excited. If you have any recommendations for where to go, please let me know.
I've got lots. Okay, Sonia, you and I can chat. And I want to hear about your trip and where you end up. Love it out there. I heard a term once was around, the term is geographical soulmate. And that's how I feel about the West Coast. Like, I feel like my heart, when I was there, it just became like, oh, this is where my heart is. And so anytime we get to go back out West, we were just back out there in late October. And, you know, the second I stepped off the plane, it was just like, I don't know, just something kind of melts away when I'm out West. It's just, yeah. So well, I'd love to hear, yeah, what you think.
Definitely. I'll send you an email or we'll set up a call and I'll just say, I found my geographical soulmate. But yeah, that wraps up all the questions that we have. Janine, do you have any more questions?
No, I'm pretty much good.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Tang, and I'll see you at our next lab meeting.
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, both. This was great.